Thank you, Mr. Rigord. Good morning to everyone. I was handed a napkin with some writing on it just a few minutes before coming up here. The message on the napkin was, in Elmira, they are receiving very good video and audio. As you know, it's been a struggle, and it looks like we've finally have the problems resolved, and I'd like to thank Bryant and Dean and Lee and everyone who's been working on this in order to make it work effectively. We really appreciate that you have done that. I guess there are a few things I'll sort of, I see I have lots of extra time. In fact, an hour and a half. Now, we're going to have to, if we can, we need to put this clock on the picture in, not really, Brian, but we need to put this clock on the screen in Elmira, because I have two grandsons, at least one who is a clock watcher. And he's whenever he sees that clock get close to the hour, he says, "Is Papa done yet?" So I have my admonition to that. A couple of things here. Hazel was gone for a week to Georgia. She wasn't in Elmira last week. She was in the state of Georgia. It was an emotional time and trip for Hazel. I would have liked to have gone with her, but I've gone so much of the time that I didn't feel that I should go there. But I just give you a little bit of information about it. She was born in a house that was built in the 1930s by her father and his brothers, using their own hands and with materials that it was a Depression era and materials weren't so available. So everything that was put in there wasn't the highest quality material, but it was home, and it was a really nice place where she was actually born in that house and lived in that house until the time that she met me. And at that time, she had just moved to Atlanta, and we met. I gobbled her up as soon as she hit the streets of Atlanta. And from that time on, she hasn't lived there, but her mother lived there until the time that she died, except for the last couple of years, she wasn't able to go there. So we kept her at home, although she argued with us about that. She was, in fact, had made arrangements to go home at one time, and I told her she could, I sat her down and told her, "You may go for a visit, but you have to come back." And she said, I am the boss. And she looked at me and she said, "Well, John, what if I don't want a boss?" I said, "Well, Mama, it doesn't really matter whether you want a boss or not. You've got one." And so she wore that as a badge of honor the last couple of years of her life, that I had said that to her. And she told a lot of people about it. Well, anyway, Hazel was in Georgia because the decision, it's kind of a difficulty family-wise for everyone in the family, but the decision was made to sell that house. We don't get there, and we didn't use it. It was deteriorating over some period of time, and so she put it up in the hands of a real estate company, and we didn't know if anybody would ever buy it or not, but somebody bought it. And so this past week, she went down there. And, of course, one of the emotional parts is taking out all of the things that are in that all of those years. And You know, some of those things that she found, she didn't even know were there. You know, she found her mother's high school graduation certificate. And she had never even seen that or known that it was there. She found pictures of herself. She found pictures of relatives she had never seen before. But anyway, it all had to be cleared out. Some of it she was able to keep, but most of it had to be put away. So it was an emotional time for her, and I guess for the whole family. So anyway, she's back and ready to go, I guess. I had a question from Gary. He wanted to know if the subject of today's sermon would be green or St. Patrick's Day or something along those lines. And yes, probably not. So I'd like to allay that fear on your behalf before I even get to giving the sermon. The things that Mr. Rigord was mentioning about the box. I visited Ed on Tuesday and talked to him. He was when I arrived in the room, he was sleeping, so I just went and sat down in the chair on the other side of his bed. He's in a room with another man, and I had just thought, if he doesn't wake up, I'll stay here for a while and I'll leave. But then about 10 minutes after I was sitting down in the chair, he woke up and I was able to have a conversation with him. And so everything seemed pretty good. Ed had a problem with his leg that he had broken. In that, he said, it just feels cold all the time. Well, that concerned me because of the fact that indicates that there's not enough circulation in the leg. And so he asked me to please touch it and see if it felt cold to me. So I pulled the sheet back and I touched his leg, and it did not. It did not feel cold. In fact, it felt warm to my touch. So I told him that. He was pleased about that. And he said, well, it just feels cold to me all the time, but your hand felt warm. And I just surmise that what he is having is a nervous reaction from the injury, but the temperature of his leg, even though it may feel cold to him, is just nerve related, not anything more. I also visited Dolores. Dolores has a difficulty getting out of the house now, and probably it's going to be unusual for her to be able to be out and do much of anything now because of those things. But had a very good visit with her. She was very happy to have me visit. I came in about 6 o'clock, which was maybe not the best time to be visiting somebody. But, you know, she was doing some work around the kitchen stove, and I stood around the stove with her, and then she went and sat down, and we talked for a while. But her attitude was pretty good. Well, later on in the week, Thursday, she called me, and she said, I'm just very discouraged. She said, I went to visit Ed, and he was awake. And lots of times Ed is spending a lot of time asleep now. She said he was awake, but he wasn't capable of putting together any kind of cogent communication at all. And so this was she just felt very disappointed and discouraged about that. So following that, I tried to encourage her and to tell her that we were continuing to pray for her about it. And so she thanked me. The next morning she called me and she said she had really a very encouraging experience that Ed had called her on the phone, and he had put together the call himself, and she felt this was a very, very good sign. She asked me to please tell you that your prayers are making a great deal of difference. So I pass that on to you from Dolores. And that's the situation with the two of them. And as Mr. Regord said, there are quite a few problems in that family. And I wasn't aware about your situation, Jim, and also about the grandson, Zachary. I didn't know that, so I'm glad to know that. And I hope everyone made notes of that. I tell you about, I think Lisa and Lori were both 21 years old. Was that how old they were, Hazel? They had this kind of constriction to their breathing. And they were at the same age and months since the time they were born that this happened to both of them, you know, 2 years apart, but they were at the same age. And so they didn't know what to think of it in the Arnold Ogden Hospital in Elmira. And so they got all kinds of specialists in there. And they determined that Lisa had whooping cough, Hazel? Diphtheria, I'm sorry. Diphtheria. She had diphtheria. And the thing about diphtheria is, diphtheria was a deadly disease. And diphtheria would kill you by, first of all, closing off your bronchial tubes until you could not breathe. And then if you got through that, and what the medics started to do, I don't know, 100 years ago, is to put tubes down your bronchial tubes into the lungs, you know, a separate tube inside the bronchial tube to force it to remain open so that you could breathe in and out. But then following that, toxins would be produced, which would also kill you. So there were two ways in which it would kill you. So they determined that they had diphtheria, nobody had ever seen it before. But in the the case of the two of them, 2 years apart, they had diphtheria. Well, they had the state patrol bring down any toxin medication from Strong Memorial because it wasn't any closer than that. And like 2 a.m. in the morning because it was so critical to get it down there. But that is an experience. But anyway, everybody, please remember to pray for Zachary. I said that, in the message I sent out, I said it seemed like all the problems were in the Elmira church. Well, there's a couple of problems I didn't know about, so please remember that. As well, the messages I got from Mark and Georgiana Borgna, Mark's father is in the hospital and has had some very serious problems with his colon and also with his ability to breathe. And he is in intensive care and remains in intensive care. Apparently, it looks very bad for Mark's brother, Kevin. Mark wrote that he is going to North Carolina today to see Kevin. And I, if I remember correctly, many years ago we had a softball team. Where's Mr. Tracy? Where's Ron Tracy? You know, he used to organize softball tournaments. But we had a softball team, and we entered in a league near Elmira. And if I remember right, it was Kevin that played with us on that team. And Mark had several brothers, so I'm not positive that I got the one correct. But anyway, Kevin has had cancer, and They tell him he's cancer-free now, but the cure might have been worse than the disease. You know, sometimes all of the things that they do to you to defeat the cancer may not produce the best results. So he's in very, very thin, very frail, fell and broke his hip. He's in the hospital, and they had told his wife that he should call, that she should call the family. So they don't look, the prospects for Kevin don't look very good. Mark Buchholz, I think you're all aware of the ongoing situation with Mark. And he had had a fever. He had been given antibiotics, and the infection that was combating was successfully defeated, but he still remains having a fever. And the fever that he has now, they don't feel it has anything to do with any infection, and so they are suspicious that there are certain drugs that they have that they continually give him, that one of the drugs may be causing that fever. So they're taking one away to see what happens, you know, the suspicious drugs that they give him. They're taking him away one at a time to see if doing that will relieve the fever. Of course, Andy, you know, has been ill now, or in a weakened condition for approximately a year. So please remember to pray for them. And this is all one family. You know, the Borgnos and the Buchholz and the Box, they are all one family. And it's hard to imagine how so many people are having so much difficulty in one family. But of course, it is the time of the Passover, and we traditionally have had for many years, as long as I've been in the church, an increase in the number of problems that occur during the Passover as we approach the Passover season. Betty Gearhart is much better, was at church last week. I am sure she's doing well now, and she was back to being feisty a little bit and fun to be with. I also sent out during the week a message. Some of you know Pat Hubbell. Probably many of you, maybe most of you, don't know Pat Hubbell. But they lived in the Binghamton area for many years. Carl was an employee of IBM. They moved to Texas back in the probably around 1990. And they have remained in Texas from that time. But Pat has been having, over some couple of years now, seizures, you know, nervous seizures. And seems like every time she goes through a series of these, they don't just, she has one seizure and then she's over it. But typically she has seizure after seizure after seizure sequentially. And it seems like every time she goes through that, she is weakened very significantly and doesn't go back to the previous state that she was in before. So, as well, somebody to be mindful of. Many people that we could be praying for at this time of the year. Okay, since I told Gary that we would not be speaking on the subject of St. Patrick's Day or anything green, what will I be speaking about? I will be speaking about somewhat related to what Mr. Nordland said during the sermonette, although it's not focusing specifically on children as he was focusing on. I will be speaking on eating unleavened bread. We are approaching the spring holy days, April 7th through April 13th. What is it that makes those days unique? What makes those days unique? What's different about those days? Well, there might be a few things that we would consider to be different about those days, but there is a specific instruction that the Bible gives us. In Exodus chapter 12 and verse 15, Mr. Norton says we're entering a time in God's calendar. Well, this is a time in God's calendar and an instruction about what we are to do during those times. Exodus chapter 12, verse 15. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. Whosoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. So I can say there are three elements to that particular verse of Scripture. It says, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. That's the first element. But then the second element is put away all the leavening from your houses. Related to eating unleavened bread, but it's also, for this period of time, and it only relates to this 7 day period of time each year. Doesn't relate to the rest of the year. The symbolism that's involved here is unique for these 7 days. You are to put away the leaven from out of your houses. And we'll talk about the symbolism of the leaven and also the symbolism of the unleavened before we finish the sermon. Whosoever, so that's the second thing. Whosoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, this is a warning that if you eat leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, it says that soul shall be cut off from Israel. Pretty strong words there. Now I have to confess that I have made a mistake once or twice over the years. And I have, during the days of unleavened bread, eaten something that I should not have eaten because I sort of lost the context of where I am and what I was doing. Not a good thing. I should be more aware. I should be focused and have my attention more directly situated on what it is that I'm doing, but there are all kinds of diversions. And I've told many of you before about the time we had a YOU meeting halfway between Elmira and Binghamton, and our friends the Box were at that meeting. And I went in and sat down, and we were starting to discuss things about YOU, and it was a restaurant, a little restaurant there. And so everybody ordered coffee so we could, you know, give them some little bit of business. And she said, anybody want anything else? I said, I'll have a donut. Dolores Bach looked at me. She says, John, you don't want a donut. I said, what's wrong with Dolores? I said, I don't want a donut. I said, yeah, I think, John, you don't want a donut. Oh, yeah, Dolores, you're right. I said to the waitress, I don't want a donut. I don't know what the waitress thought about this or what is this woman doing telling me what I want and what I don't want. But, of course, Dolores did know. And she was correct. So this is saying here, though, if you eat leavened bread, I mean, this last part of the scripture. If you eat leavened bread, and I don't think it's talking here just about a mistake that you might have made, but if you are constant, if you make a decision that you will eat leavened bread in spite of the instruction of God, then you are cutting yourself off from Israel. Our understanding of the first element of this verse of Scripture has changed over the years. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. I'm going to be focusing on that part of this verse of Scripture in this sermon. I remember, you probably scarcely think this is possible, 44 years ago, the first day of unleavened bread that I went to. It was in Gadsden, Alabama. And the Atlanta and the Alabama churches met together in a hotel there. On the night to be much remembered, we had I guess it was conference room reserved. And we all together, the two churches, Alabama and Birmingham, assembled and had the night to be much observed together at that time. And that was it was a magic time for me to enjoy that and to see that and to start to understand for the first time what was going on. From that time, through the years, we continually have emphasized this verse of Scripture. But as I say, probably 10, 12 years ago, I don't remember exactly when now, our understanding of the first phrase here changed. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. We didn't change it. We didn't change our understanding. Did not change about the remainder of the Scripture. We were to put out leavening from the houses. And we've always continued to do that. Whosoever eats leavened bread from the first to the seventh, nobody ever advocated eating leavened bread during that period of time. So I'm just dealing here with the first, and I counted it up, 7 words of this verse of Scripture. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. We were admonished for, I don't know, 30 years anyway of my time in the church, that it was a requirement we are to eat unleavened bread, some bit of unleavened bread every day for those 7 days. And the church position paper was issued probably 10, 12 years ago. I'm just guessing at that. I don't know what it when it was issued, but it seems to me it was about that long ago. To explain the first 7 days, the first 7 words of this verse of Scripture. The conclusion of that position paper was that this Scripture is not saying that we must eat unleavened bread for the 7 days. Now, I think there were many of us in the ministry and many of the people in the church who did not understand that explanation in the way that it was made. But that was the conclusion of the position paper. That we are not required, and there were certain reasons that they gave it, even though it's translated here, 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. It was explained in the position paper why it is that the conclusion was being reached that we were not being required to eat unleavened bread for all of those 7 days. This past year, and I didn't look it up I could have maybe hunted through, spent hours hunting through all of my email messages and so forth and all of the things that came from the home office. A statement was made that there was going to be a change in that position paper, and that we would be teaching that we are to eat unleavened bread for some unleavened bread every day for the 7 days. I waited for the appearance of the position paper, and the position paper never came. I didn't want to give a message saying something that would later be rescinded or something that wasn't approved by the church. So I kept waiting. It never came. Finally, a week or so ago, I called Victor Kubik, head of ministerial services, to ask if there would be a position paper issued regarding this. Mr. Kubik told me we will be taking down the other position paper, and he acted as though he wasn't quite sure if it had already been taken down or not, but it would be being taken down. But probably, he said, we will not be issuing a new position paper stating that you must eat some unleavened bread every day. I thought, based on what, and I'll give you a lot. I'll be paraphrasing what he told me. I don't have it, recorded so that I could play it back, in every element to you. But I'll be paraphrasing what he told me in that conversation as we go through this matter. But I thought, not that I think it, that there are any of you who are not already eating unleavened bread every day for the 7 days, but I thought it would be good if we clarified to the extent we can the matter so that we all understood it the same way. So I'll be speaking about the meaning of the first seven words of Exodus chapter 12 and verse 15. And as I said, I think I come to a different conclusion than the position paper which was issued some time back. Question is, that I start with here, if we no longer feel that position paper was correct, why don't we issue a new position paper? Why don't we issue a new position paper to correct what we feel was an error in the previous one? I'll give you a little bit of background about how that position paper came to be. The church has a doctrinal committee. Various questions of doctrine are considered by the doctrinal committee, and the doctrinal committee issues judgments on behalf of the church regarding doctrinal questions. Now, these judgments that the doctrinal committee may issue are not questions about do we keep the Sabbath, or is the law of committing murder done away with, or is it now permitted to lie, commit adultery, steal? I mean, the doctrinal committee is not vested with the authority to consider the major questions, but to consider the smaller matters in how we may keep certain doctrines in the church. One of those has to do with what is being said here in these first seven words of that scripture. Other things that the church has had to consider over the years that I can think of, just to sort of put you in the understanding of how the doctrinal committee functions, divorce and remarriage. What are the parameters around which divorce and remarriage may be considered. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is part of that. There were questions about new moons. There were questions about sacred names, dates of the holy days, various kind of limited understanding, not about whether we are to obey God, but exactly what does the Bible have to say about these things. I have to say I cannot explain to you why this ever became an issue in the first place. That the judgment that came from it, it's not necessary for us to eat unleavened bread every day for the 7 days. I don't know why that became an issue. It's a very big piece of information to be missing, but there obviously had to be some reason why it came to be an issue. But I don't know what it is, and I have to tell you forthrightly, I don't know why it became an important issue. I would say that the doctrinal committee that made the decision was doing it in all sincerity, and the decision was made earnestly. So I don't take I don't question their sincerity or the heart that they made the judgment out of. The judgment, however, was questioned widely among the ministry from the beginning, and it was also questioned widely among the membership. Although everybody accepted it, although I think most people continued to practice what they had always understood and been taught. That's what we did. You know, I didn't speak about it publicly. I spoke about it a few times with different ministers. I tried not to really be talking about it to the membership because I thought it was inappropriate for me to express an opinion which was contradictory to what was being held by the church. I say that in general, the decision was not widely understood. And I say probably, I don't think most people took it as an occasion to avoid eating unleavened bread. Although probably some few did. I don't know of anybody in either one of our two churches who took it that way. But many people questioned it or felt it was mistaken. Thing is, still talking about the background of how and why this decision was made, the makeup of the doctrinal committee has changed dramatically in the past 2 years. And consequently, the people who are now part of the doctrinal committee are those who feel that at least in a majority, that we are to eat unleavened bread for 7 days. So that's a little bit about the background. Now, Mr. Kubik told me the church will stop short and emphasize those points. Stop short of issuing a new position paper stating that you must eat unleavened bread for 7 days. The church is going to stop short of issuing that. But the church feels that it is appropriate that we are to be eating unleavened bread for all 7 days. It's just that, he said, the church is not willing to go quite that far because there are certain limited exceptions, and he quoted to me some of the limited exceptions that make it difficult for everybody everywhere to be able to eat unleavened bread. It's not a problem for you and I, but he says in certain places in Africa and Asia, very difficult for them to be able to get the materials, the unleavened bread that they need to be able to do that. So that's a limited exception. For only a very few people in very remote places, he says it's very difficult for them to do that. So we're not going to say as a church, you have to do it, or, you know, vernacular, if you don't do it, you're going to burn forever, an ever-burning hellfire. That's not... It is, unless you are in some sort of a difficulty, it is something that you must do. So that's one of the exceptions he quoted, Africa and Asia. And then he quoted another exception in that some people have food allergies. And those people who have food allergies and are unable to eat that kind of thing, we don't want to say that you must eat it because of that. He mentioned to me that it's the same kind of thing as we may have with a very few people who do not feel they can have any alcohol, any wine containing wine on the Passover, because even that little bit would cause them, as they are alcoholics, self-admitted alcoholics, that even that small amount of alcohol might cause them to have a relapse in their commitment to not ever have any more alcohol. So he said, we have allowed those people to have grape juice. He said that we have some people who have food allergies. Well, we're talking here very limited exceptions. We're not talking about anything that I know of that would affect any of us. We're certainly not in remote places where we couldn't get unleavened bread. And I don't know of anybody that has that kind of a food allergy. There may be somebody I don't know about. Victor said, and I might have the number wrong here. He said, there has never been a time, a day. He's got a better memory than I do, because I thought I can't say this myself. There has never been a day in his 43 years during the days of unleavened bread when he did not eat some unleavened bread. And he doesn't think that there ever will be. And he was making that statement to demonstrate the level of commitment that he felt was important to have in that regard. So that's the statement. The church is not going to issue a new, is probably not going to issue a new position paper saying it is a requirement that you eat unleavened bread every day. Even though it's only the reason for not issuing that paper is to allow for a few rather infrequent exceptions. Victor also mentioned the question about fasting. And he said, and this was a part of the position paper, if somebody wants to fast during the days of unleavened bread, must they then eat unleavened bread when they are fasting? I'll address that a little bit more. I answered him what I thought, and I'll be addressing that a little bit more here as we continue through this subject. The decision of the 10-year-old, however old it is, position paper, that we did not need to eat unleavened bread every day. Never said we don't need to eat unleavened bread, but the question was asked, do we need to eat it every day? I always said we needed to eat it. But 7 days must you eat unleavened bread. Question was, do we really need to do that? And the And the answer to the question was based in major part on a comparative analysis, reasoning, comparing different scriptures. Exodus 20. I'm just giving you the reasoning that was made in this position paper some years ago. Exodus 20, verse 9, has to do with keeping the weekly Sabbath. 6 days, here's the phrase, shall you labor. Like it's saying in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 15, 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. Now here's the comparison. 6 days shall you labor. Is it a requirement that all 6 days of every week you must labor? I don't think anybody would come to that conclusion, that you never get a day off. But it says, 6 days shall you labor. So it's comparing the shall you labor to the shall you eat. And since the conclusion is, the comparison that is made, and the conclusion is that no, it doesn't really mean that every day for all 6 days of every week you must labor. Therefore, if we conclude that from the same wording, the conclusion about eating unleavened bread is that it's not really saying you must eat unleavened bread for 7 days any more than it's saying you must work every day during the week. So that was a comparative argument that was made. I tried to, the statement that I remember from that position paper was that there was a specific word which was translated into shall. And the word was identical in those two scriptures. Therefore, we had to conclude that the meaning of those two would be identical. In my Strong's Concordance, I don't see a word there for the word that's translated into shall. I mean, sibiyam dot, 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 you know, 7 days, dot, 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 matzah, and the dot, dot is translated shall you eat. But I don't see a specific word that's there. Nor do I see it in the 6 days dot, dot, labor. You know, 6 days shall you labor. It looks to me like, based on what I can see in my Strong's Concordance, that it was translator's choice of words. But I have to say that I believe that the people who looked at this had some text that had a word that I don't have in my Strong's Concordance. And I believe that what they said, that there is an identical word there, is true. They undoubtedly had access to resources I do not have. I would stipulate or concede that there must be, based on what they're said, wording which is identical. This is the most important element, I think, to that argument about whether or not we should eat unleavened bread that was made in this position paper. I think that that comparison is not a valid comparison, and consequently, I feel the conclusion is also not valid. And here's one of the reasons I would feel that. Even though I would stipulate the word is identical, I know this about Hebrew. Hebrew doesn't have anything like as large a vocabulary as the English language does. And in Hebrew, a word may be used which means, could mean, for example, shall, or it could mean may. So there's a broader definition for the words which we don't have. The translator chose in this case, at least in the King James, to translate in both cases, shall. Shall. Maybe it would have been a better translation in the end of the English language to say, 6 days may you work. You don't have to. But I would think that the words are broad enough to allow it to be translated either as may or shall. May or must. Painfully, I will also say to you that I feel this is a comparison of apples and oranges. You know, apples and, I mean, I've heard that said so many times throughout my life that it is so trite that it pains me to admit I have to say this as one of the best explanations I can make about what I'm saying. We are comparing apples to oranges whenever we start comparing the secular wheat to something that God has established and says is holy. When we say that the secular wheat says that the scripture about the secular work says secular wheat says certain things, and then say, therefore, we can extrapolate on that for an occasion that God calls holy. I'm just doubtful we can do that. I think we're comparing painfully apples and oranges. In no place will you find, I would challenge you, that you would find this, anywhere in the Bible that it says the 6 days of the week, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, are referred to as holy. They are the apples. Leviticus chapter 23. And verse 6. On the 15th day of the same month, the first month of the year, is the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days. You must eat unleavened bread. Now, if you go back and look at the first part of Leviticus 23, you find that God is calling out all of those occasions He considers to be holy here in the book in the chapter in the 23rd chapter of Leviticus, and it is being referred to, I would argue to you here. The days of unleavened bread are oranges, not apples. It's being called out here as a holy occasion. If you want some more confirmation about that, and the contrast between the secular week and this 1 7-day period, which Leviticus 23 says is a holy occasion, you can get that from looking at Numbers chapter 28. Now, Numbers chapter 28 is a chapter where all of the offerings are called out. There in Numbers chapter 28, I'll read you verse 3. You shall say to them, God is passing this information on, you shall say to them, this is the offering made by fire, which you shall offer unto the Lord, two lambs of the first year, without spot, day by day, for a continual burnt offering. So every day of the year, it is saying, every day, all the secular days and all of the holy occasions and so forth, every day of the year, a continual burnt offering was to be offered. In addition, on certain occasions which are called out in Leviticus 23 as being separate and distinct occasions which turn apples into oranges, there were additional special offerings to be made. Here you find in verse 24 of Numbers 28, and if you're interested in seeing, you know, as what the Bible is calling holy occasions, read the whole chapter. See what additional offerings were offered on each day. And you know that those days which only required this continual burnt offering from verse 3, they're secular days. But when additional offerings are called for to be made, it is because God has ordained those days as being higher, above, and special. Holy occasions. Verse 24. After this manner, you shall offer daily throughout the 7 days, talking about the 7 days of unleavened bread. I'm not going to try and read you the whole, you know, all of the technical information that's here in Numbers 28. But during the 7 days of unleavened bread, the meat of the sacrifice made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord, it shall be offered beside, or which means in addition to, the continual burnt offering and his drink offering. So these additional offerings to be made throughout the 7 days of unleavened bread distinguish them from the ordinary days. So if we're making a comparison between a scripture that has to do with a secular week and a scripture that has to do with a holy occasion, I think the comparison is flawed. That's my opinion. I mentioned to you earlier, the question was also brought up at this time, what if a person wants to fast during the days of unleavened bread? Would that person not be allowed to fast because of needing to eat unleavened bread for 7 days? Leviticus chapter 23. Verses 1 and 2. The Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, say to them concerning thee, feast. Concerning the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocation, these are my feasts. I just asked this question. Well, let's read verse 6 before I make that comment. The 15th day of the 7th month is the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. If God calls these occasions feast days, is it appropriate for us to fast on a feast day? I don't think it is, myself. I think God is saying they are feast days. And we are to be festive in our outlook, our approach, and our attitude, not in an attitude of fasting. Now, I would stop short, as the church is saying, we should stop short of saying everybody must eat unleavened bread for 7 days. I would stop short of saying there is never a very, very rare, a very unusual occasion when it may not be appropriate to fast during the days of unleavened bread. But I think in general, except for what may be the rarest of exceptions, that it is a time of feasting. All of God's occasions are a time of feasting. Of course, the one exception that we know of every year, called a feast day, but it's called a feast day when we must fast, is the Day of Atonement. And that's by command of God and how that day is to be observed. So that's my feeling about what it says about fasting. That is a personal opinion. That is not. I don't know of anybody else in the church that has made that kind of a comment, but that's my personal comment. So please, I don't necessarily often like to make personal comments, but that is one that I'm willing to make on this subject. Symbolism. Mr. Norland was making some comments in regard to that in the sermonette. But we are keeping these days, and I think this relates back into the matter, should we be eating every day unleavened bread for the entire 7 days? It has to do with the symbolism. I think the symbolism ultimately kind of rules the day. There is a symbolism involved with leavened bread. And of course, that's not at issue here. But there's also a symbolism involved with unleavened bread. What is it that unleavened bread stands for during these 7 days and these 7 days only? 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 8. Let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness. So that's not at issue. But here's the symbolism that is at issue here. Let us keep it with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Now, to me, I'm just extrapolating maybe. But to me, to say that I don't need to eat unleavened bread every day for 7 days infers to me that there may be a time during this period of time that I don't need to be developing, putting in the real unleavened bread, not just the physical unleavened bread, but the real true unleavened bread, which is sincerity and truth. Is there a time when I shouldn't be doing that? Is there a time when it's okay not to do that during the days of unleavened bread? I don't think there's a time during the days of unleavened bread. That's what the whole festival is about. It travels under that name, the days of unleavened bread. And we should be, in our own personal lives, spiritually putting in the true unleavened bread into our lives, which is sincerity and truth. And there's never a day during those 7 days that we should not be doing that. God has given us a physical reminder that says to us, we are to be putting in sincerity and truth into our lives. And it's just a little piece of crusty bread. But we need to be doing that as a reminder, because we are physical, and it is an important thing that we are really doing. It is a spiritual thing. So I would say, based on that, for 7 days, we are to eat, physically eat, unleavened bread, and at the same time, to be spiritually eating the true unleavened bread, which is sincerity and truth. I would just say here, the spiritual principle rules the physical observance. Question is, a physical observance required? Well, I conclude, as much as anything, that it is required, because the spiritual principle is required. So I would say the spiritual principle rules the physical observance on this occasion, in this matter. Well, I guess we're going to give them back about 10 minutes here. The church is stopping just short. It's not saying it's not necessary to eat unleavened bread. It's stopping saying short. Everybody, under all circumstances, at all times, must. It's stopping just short of that. But it's not stopping short of saying that we who have the opportunity and have no problem in doing it, we must eat unleavened bread for 7 days. That stopping short is only for certain limited exceptions. Unless we fall into some very unusual category, we should eat unleavened bread every day for 7 days.